Hi everyone, I'm your host NG, and welcome to the 57th episode of the podcast, Sounds About Right, Audiobooks Help Us Understand the World. And on this episode, I was joined by Mary Jane Rubenstein, author of the book Astrotopia, The Dangerous Religion of the Corporate Space Race. And this book gives a revealing look at the parallel mythologies behind the colonization of Earth and space, and a bold vision for a more equitable, responsible future, both on and beyond our planet. It was great to discuss the book with MJ, and I hope you enjoy the episode. You say that the big argument in the book is that the intensifying new space race is as much a mythological project as it is a political, economic, or scientific one. But how does the mythology hold all the other efforts together?
Oh, wow, that's a fantastic question. Let me start by clarifying what I mean when I say that the current space race, it relies on mythological assumptions. What I mean is that there are some assumptions that we in the scientific, secular, kind of westernized world have about who's important, what's important, and how we should relate to one another in the world. And that these assumptions are actually assumptions. They're not objective. They are not universal. They come from a particular place. And the place that they tend to come, in the West at least, are the sort of long religious inheritance, particularly of an imperial style Christianity that kind of took over everything else and let other ways of knowing go. So when I say that there are mythological assumptions underlying the space race, what I mean are things like, one, humanity is the most important species on this planet. This is not an assumption that a lot of non-monotheistic traditions would teach. And yet it seems to be just sort of second nature to secular scientific culture. But it's a mythological assumption that comes from the monotheistic teaching that says that humans are in charge of the rest of the created world, that they're separate from it, and that they're more important than everything else, and that they are made in the image of God. So it may be that secular science has ditched the whole God thing and ditched the whole Bible thing, but they've still retained this idea that humans are the most important thing out there. Another mythological assumption is the idea that land is inanimate, that it's just there for us to do whatever we need to do with it, that land contains resources, that resources are resources. These are, again, I want to say, mythological assumptions, because not everybody believes this. For some people, land is kin. For some people, land is ancestry. For some people, land is a set of persons with whom one can relate, and not just a set of resources. So it's this kind of, there are others, but it's like this sneaky mythology that insists itself that presents itself as objective, as universally true, but that actually comes from originally like a religious place. And this is what I'm trying to show. I do think it's a great question. I do think that the mythology holds the economics and the politics and the science together, because the economics and the politics and the science are only possible based on that set of stories and that set of assumptions. You wouldn't be able to have the kind of economics that supports untrammeled profiteering, constant extraction at a fever pitch to get as much stuff as you can out of the land. You wouldn't be able to support that kind of economics if, for example, the mountain were alive or the mountain were an ancestor. You just couldn't, right? So there are these mythological assumptions sort of help set up the economics that we need for late capitalism, the politics that we need for representational democracy or communism or socialism or whatever it is that we're up to, and certainly the kind of science that proceeds technologically to try to objectify nature and understand everything that we possibly can about it.
Why should we care about Bible stories in a book that's about outer space then, MJ?
So I think we should just care about Bible stories because they are the stories, whether anybody knows it or not, that are animating the dominant actors in the contemporary space program. And I know it sounds crazy. I know that folks want to say, you know, this is science. This is rocketry. It's like the absolute opposite of religion. It has nothing to do with religion. But here's the thing. I think that we're seeing increasingly that science, which thought that it was for a long time that it was free of, say, politics or economics, just like pure science. When it comes to outer space, you can see quite clearly that science only operates by means of, say, military operations, right? It needs that support. Science only is going to get the funding it needs if it can have the economic support of a capitalist economy. So we're bringing our politics along with us when we go to, say, the moon. We have since the Cold War. We're bringing increasingly our economics along with us when we head into outer space, looking to expand the earthly economy extraterrestrially. We bring all kinds of things. And it turns out we bring religion along as well, whether or not we know it. And we bring it in the form, sometimes it's really obvious. Sometimes it's like, when Apollo 8 circled the moon, they read the book of Genesis. So I'm saying you should care about the Bible because the astronauts care. Not because I necessarily care about them, but like they did it. They read the first chapter of the Hebrew Bible, which becomes, right, the first part of the Christian New Testament. They did it. So I think that we need to attend to it, right? So that's, you know, that's clear. Buzz Aldrin consumed the Eucharist on the moon. It was the first food and drink consumed on the moon, was a consecrated wafer and wine. But then there are these more kind of subtle ways that we bring religion up with us. And again, these are in the assumptions that we have about who counts, right? When you hear about space settlements, you don't hear a lot of people talking about space settlements that involve coyotes and zebras and maple trees. You hear them talking about people, like growing the plants they need to survive. People and potatoes, like those are the things that you hear about. Why potatoes? Because we love potatoes? No, because we need the potatoes to survive, right? That assumption, again, that the humans are the most important things in the universe, this is a mythological assumption. Again, we bring it with us whether or not we like to or not. And sometimes it's super straightforward and very clear, and sometimes it's a little more subtle.
Hmm. And you touch on in the book, the Christians' victory over paganism. How integral was this from turning a world full of living things to a world full of objects for us to absorb and consume?
Yes. So this is an argument I get from a historian from the 1970s and 60s called Lynn White Jr. And his argument is that the advent of capitalism and of technoscience needs the Christian victory over paganism just to take root. And what he means is, just as you've said, in various pagan traditions, the word pagan is funny. I mean, there are these days people who call themselves pagans, but historically, paganism was just a nasty thing that you said about people who were not Christian. And who were not Jewish and who were not Muslim. For Christians, there were Jews, there were Muslims. They were bad, but like at least they would call them Jews and Muslims. And then there were pagans. That was just everybody else. And broadly speaking, in what are understood to be pagan traditions, the idea is that the more than human world, the world of which we are a part, is filled with all kinds of persons, non-human persons, that animals are persons, but also that rivers are persons, and that trees are persons. And I think most indigestibly for some Westerners, that some rocks are persons. Some rocks have personhood. Some mountains are ancestors, things like that. And so what Lynn White Jr. says is, look, if you affirm the forest as a set of beings with whom you have a relationship, then in order to take any of the wood from that forest, you need to ask. You got to ask the forest, right? Whether it's the spirits of the forest or the forest itself, or, you know, whatever it is you think about the forest. And you have to take only what you need. You can't just take everything you can. You take what you need. And then you make a pact, because this is a relationship. You say, thank you, forest, for your wood. We will plant more trees so that we can grow. So there's a reciprocity between these actors. These are broad strokes, right? But the idea is that if you can affirm the animacy, the personhood of the more than human world, you live in a more balanced relationship to it. It is only when we are taught that nothing but humans have personhood and that human beings are in charge of everything else. And this is what Genesis says, right? humans are made in the image of God and humans are given dominion over the earth, that the idea of just exploiting the world as much as we possibly can comes into feasibility. Because now, oh, great, if the river's not alive, we can dam it without asking it, right? If the forest doesn't have spirits, we can clear cut it with impunity without any problems. So anyway, that's the Lynn White argument. He does get accused of painting in excessively broad brushstrokes. I think this is fair. Certainly not all kinds of Christianities teach this kind of ethic. This includes the contemporary Pope, the Pope of the Roman Catholic Church, who says, like, we have to stop behaving this way toward nature. So really, anybody who thinks critically and contemporarily about the Genesis story these days is going to say that's a terrible reading of Genesis. And yet it is the reading of Genesis that teamed up, unfortunately, with a kind of imperialism, European imperialism, to justify the conquest of the globe. Anyway, that's the idea.
So in the past, the West exploring new frontiers has been at the expense of people or others. So should we be wary that this space race will be any different?
Let me start from a point of agreement, a point that I've found that everybody, no matter what their position is on the contemporary efforts in space, agree on. And that point of agreement is that space is being used as a kind of final frontier. That the effort to colonize outer space is an extension of the effort to colonize the Earth. Everybody agrees on that. It just is. We call space the final frontier. There are all these parallels drawn to, you know, particularly there's the European conquest of the so-called New World. And then there's the, you know, white European expansion across the American continent. They hit California, which was said to be the last frontier. And then in the 1950s, it turns out like, oh, wait, no. There's a final last frontier, and that's outer space. So everybody draws this comparison. Whether you're for it or against it, the comparison is there. The question is whether or not it's okay, whether or not it's okay to do it. And what I've found that's really interesting is that, you know, there are the anti-colonial types who say we cannot take a colonial mindset into outer space. Why? Because it displaced and destroyed indigenous peoples and communities, because it exploited particularly Black labor and indigenous labor in the U.S. and creates a sort of permanent class of exploited laborers, and because it destroyed the Earth. So let's not do that again elsewhere. Those are the anti-colonialists. The pro-colonialists, the folks who do think that we should absolutely head off and conquer out of space, interestingly say, they will admit that terrestrial colonialism was not perfect, that like there were flaws. They will say like, oops, all that frontierism did in fact displace and destroy indigenous communities. Right, all of that expansionists did in fact exploit laborers, particularly laborers of color. They will say these things, but they will say outer space is different. Like, it's different this time because there's nobody there, right? There's nobody there. And also there aren't even any like rivers or trees to destroy this time. We can't destroy, we could absolutely attack the moon forever and it wouldn't matter because there's nothing there. There's like, you know, we're sorry about what we did on the Earth, but like this time the approach is actually justified because there's literally nothing there. So that's the idea.
And when we look at the known interested parties in the space race, we think of Elon Musk with SpaceX and Jeff Bezos with Blue Origin. But what are both of their ideologies as to why they want to go to space, and how do they differ from one another, MJ?
Right. Yeah, this is really fascinating. Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos are often lumped together as like super, super wealthy dudes who want to conquer space. And that's fair enough. But they do have very different motivations for going, apart from making money. Like, of course, everybody wants to, all these guys want to make money. But they have very different motivations for going, and they have very different plans once you get there. The Musk model, I think, is better known. What Musk says is that at some point, either in the near future or in the far off future, something is going to obliterate humanity. That may be an asteroid. that we just can't avert. It may be nuclear war that demolishes most of the species. It could eventually be, you know, the explosion of our sun and it's becoming a red dwarf. But like either in a near term or a long term way, like something is going to obliterate humanity. So either humanity goes the way of the dinosaurs and goes extinct, which he thinks is just like an unthinkable prospect, or we go get a backup planet. We plant some humans elsewhere with human knowledge, human understanding, human history, human culture, start a new community somewhere else. And it's like a backup drive for humanity. Now, of course, when the sun explodes, Mars is the planet that he wants. Mars is going to go too, right? When the sun explodes. But he says, we're only going to be able to make it out of our solar system and to other, to exoplanets if we've already made it to. So Mars is like a stepping stone. First Mars, then maybe some of the moons of Jupiter or Saturn, then maybe Pluto. And then from Pluto, we get out of the solar system entirely and start seeding ourselves throughout the universe. That's the Musk idea. And again, why Mars? Because Mars is close and Venus is close too, but Venus is just too damn hot. Like it's like 900 degrees Fahrenheit. You can't be there. Mars is a disaster, but it's not as bad as Venus, you know, all things considered. Bezos has a different sense of the emergency. Bezos talks much more about climate change than Musk does, as one of our impending problems. And what he focuses on is our use of energy and the way that our reliance on energy has contributed to climate change. And the problem for Bezos is that as technology advances, human beings want more and more energy. They have to power more and more devices. They have to use more and more things. We have got more and more cars, more and more appliances, more and more air conditioning, more and more hospitals, more and more, right? So we need increasingly more energy, but we're on a finite planet that just doesn't have the resources to support an increasing energy reliance. We don't have enough oil. We don't have enough natural gas. And we don't actually even have enough surface area to get all of the solar energy that we would need. Our atmosphere blocks out a good deal of the solar energy. So like even if we covered the whole damn Earth in solar panels, we couldn't get enough. So what do we do? Bezos, again, there's the sort of thrown away alternative, which is like, well, we could stop using so much energy. And Bezos thinks that's a ridiculous idea because that would be boring and backward or something like that. So what we should do instead is not go to Mars. Bezos is smart here. He's like, Mars is a hellhole. Mars is terrible. It's like really cold. There's nothing there. It will radiate you to death and probably make you very stupid. It's a very bad planet. Why not instead construct these like space habitats between the Earth and the Moon that will orbit Earth? They'll be like rotating shopping malls, basically. And you can set them spinning on their own axes to simulate gravity so people could actually walk around. And what you can do is you can relocate a lot of the heavy industry from Earth onto these space pods or onto asteroids, so that you remove a lot of the polluting industries and stick them out into space. Also, you move a good deal of the human population onto space pods as well, and you give the Earth a little more breathing room, let the Earth recover by offloading a bunch of people on the planet. So yeah, different senses of problems and different senses of solutions in these two.
Yeah, so I learned from your book just how the temperature and conditions are of Mars. Definitely don't want to go there. And just when it comes to Bezos's idea, once again, it just brings a question whether there's any respect for what is already there in space, doesn't it?
Yes. My sense is that there isn't, that the dominant understanding is that there just isn't anything out there, nothing of worth, which again is eerily similar to what Europeans thought about Africa, the New World, Australia, that there just wasn't anything there. And again, when you say to the folks who really want to conquer space, look, we did this already, right? Europe already declared that there was nothing in these lands that they colonized and used that to justify like untold violence against all sorts of people. They'll say, yeah, that was a mistake. There were actually people there and we messed up. But like this time... There are no people, no productions, nothing of importance. So it's okay this time. As you can probably hear from the way that I'm saying this, I don't think that it's the case. I think that it's just a bad doctrine, the idea that if you think that there's nothing of worth there, you can do anything you'd like to it. I don't think that it's suddenly justifiable now that we're talking about outer space in a way that it wasn't when we're talking about terrestrial colonialism. But that's just me.
And I guess that brings the further question of, will the space race be beneficial for everyone on Earth or just a select few people, MJ?
Well, it totally depends on who you're counting, right? That from the beginning, from the moment that Neil Armstrong walked on the moon, he said, this is a small step for a man and it is a giant step for mankind. And the question is, was it a giant step for mankind? And I think that you can answer that question in a number of different ways. You can say, well, humanity's increased presence in space has allowed more and more people to have, computers in their pockets, communicate with satellites that communicate, right? Has allowed more and more people to have high speed internet, has allowed more and more people to have medical devices that speak to a satellite and then give them insulin, things like that, right? It's also the case that, first of all, not everybody has access to these technologies. And second of all, we wouldn't need a lot of these technologies if we hadn't been participating in the kinds of economies that are now sending us into outer space, right? It has now become impossible for communities to live without the internet. So yes, of course, you have to have high-speed internet, but you only have to have high-speed internet because our economy has created an economy in which you need high-speed internet. It's not like a basic human right. So the bigger question for me is, certainly, yes, our presence in space has improved access to technology for people who need access to technology because now we need access to technology. But has it improved people's access to clean water and clean air, to affordable rents, to healthcare, to things like that? I think that that's a more complicated calculus that one would have to do. And it's this kind of question, I think, that gave rise to that. I don't know if you've heard that Gil Scott-Heron song, Whitey on the Moon, where he's like, huh. He's like living in an underfunded, terrible apartment with his sister and perhaps more of his family. And he's like, my rent conditions are absurd. I can't afford my rent because my landlord can't afford his taxes because we're all paid too little because the government doesn't have enough money and it's not getting any threat. And all of this stuff is happening. And like a rat bit my sister because of the squalid conditions of this apartment. And there's some white dude like bouncing about on the moon. Millions and millions of dollars, and like I can't get clean water. I think it's an important critique. I think it's an important question to ask, and I don't see straightforward analyses of the way that our increased presence in space helps folks who are struggling to make rent and struggling to feed themselves and their kids and to get access to healthcare. I hear a lot about how we have great internet, and that's delightful, but I don't know that needs to be the first of our concerns.
Absolutely. There was a part in the book where part of that song or poem was read out, and it struck a chord with me, I'll be honest. And also, I'm tying in another part of the book as well, where you just mentioned the welfare for billionaires, So there's people that are living in certain conditions, whereas I suppose because Obama allowed the part privatization of the space race, it's allowed these billionaires, who people are already rich, to now, be given more money to essentially explore further space, whilst people are living in not so great conditions here on Earth already, unfortunately.
That's right. Right. The taxes that are supposed to go to the government to ensure the basic well-being of people, those taxes, in some ways are going to ensure the basic well-being of people, of bridges and roads and things like that. But a good proportion of them are actually going now to these space billionaires as government contracts. So, and as you know, a lot of them themselves are tax dodgers. So they're not paying taxes. And in fact, they're receiving taxes. I think that this is what folks mean when they talk about welfare for billionaires.
Lastly, is there a better way to go about space exploration than what is currently being done?
Yeah, I think there are lots of better ways to go about it. And part of the reason that I find it so important to hone in on the stories that are animating the space race is to say, okay, if our big problem is that some bad stories are dictating the way that we're behaving, why not unearth some better stories? And there are better stories about how to live in relation to Earth, how to live in relation to nature, how to live in relation to space, and how to live in relation to other human beings all over the place. Like, there are tons of people who know better ways to live. So I've tried in this book to listen to the stories of certainly Afrofuturist authors, Indigenous futurist authors, feminist and queer speculative fiction writers, but also people who reinterpret, you know, the Christian and Jewish and Muslim canon to say different things. All sorts of people who say, you know what, we need to be living differently in relation to one another. We need to be thinking about kinship with the land. We need to be thinking about kinship with one another. We need to be thinking about putting relationships over profit, things like that. So anyway, there are tons of voices out there. The question is, I think now, how do we get from those better sorts of stories to like actual space policy, right? And I think that there is a kind of sliding scale of different ways that one could intervene, from like tiny minimal adjustments. Tiny minimal adjustments to the space program would be something like increase regulation on corporations so that at least they have to do things like environmental impact studies, which they do not have to do right now. There is thought to be no environmental impact when you're talking about outer space. So you don't even have to do that, right? Little changes. Let SpaceX workers unionize. There are mitigation measures that you can take to make the corporate conquest of space like a little kinder. That's one way. You could go for a more intense model and try to stir up some international regulation that reaffirms some early space litigation that actually announces planetary bodies as commons, as spaces that are supposed to be open to, but also preserved for everybody, not like open season kind of commons. But so there are certainly space lawyers who are trying to work on totally international multilateral cooperations that are generated from the international community, not say from the US that then says, all right, come on and go along with us, but that are genuinely internationally generated. This would be a more intense mitigation measure. And there are things there you would need to do, like the US has to start talking to China when it comes to outer space. We have to get rid of that piece of legislation that says that the US can't cooperate with China at all on space affairs. We would also need something like a global space traffic management system so that everybody knows what's going on, what everybody is up to, so that there aren't disastrous collisions in outer space. Again, these are all sort of like real politic ways to go about things. Then there are more intense things we could do. It could be possible in theory to designate outer space as a scientific research laboratory, like the way Antarctica is, for example, to say like we cannot support space tourism because of the kind of carbon that it dumps into the universe. And we don't think it's particularly healthy for people to be like living in outer space. We should do this for research purposes. This is right. There are precedents. There are ways to do that. Or the sort of most outlandish way to think about outer space differently is precisely to follow those leads of people like Sun Ra, people like N.K. Jemisin, all of the like cadre of like, blossoming indigenous futurists who imagine life in outer space as built on fundamentally different communities from the ones that we've built on Earth, which is to say built on respect and love and the priority of relationship and care over profit and things like that. That's the sort of most outlandishly dreamerly way of doing things. But again, it's not absurd. There are plenty of people who think it, and if you think it, you can do it, right? And this is why I think it's so important to turn to fiction, and particularly speculative fiction and some science fiction, as a way of reimagining, because again, all we are comes out of our stories. All we do, all we build, comes out of the stories that we tell. And if we can tell better stories, we can actually build better communities.
That was Mary Jane Rubenstein, author of the book Astrotopia, The Dangerous Religion of the Corporate Space Race. The book and audiobook is available now. which I do recommend you to pick up and read or to give a listen to. A big thank you to MJ for coming on the podcast, and thank you for listening to this episode. If you enjoyed this episode, please rate the podcast and check out some of the previous ones if you haven't done already. And until then, I'll catch you on the next. Thank you.